Here to help us understand what exactly Shatner's doing up there and what it means for the future of space travel is one of our favorite guests, one of the most popular guests that we have, not only on this show, but on the station as a whole, and a guy with the best voice in all of radio, bar none, Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. He is a veteran radio and TV broadcaster and an edutainer who has a great deal of expertise in both astronomy and space. He joins us now. Steve, thanks so much for joining me once again on the radio.
Always a pleasure, Frank. Good to be here on 77 WABC. What an exciting day this is going to be indeed. And as you were mentioning and hearing some of the audio clips and some of the replays from television, yeah, William Shatner, it's going to be an amazing day, not only for him, but from space. And I got to stand on a soapbox for a moment. A year ago, almost to the date, I was privileged and honored to have William Shatner on the Dr. Sky Show, but he didn't really want to talk about space at that time. He wanted to talk about one of his latest blues albums, but I kind of squeezed one out there as far as getting a question in, and he basically was telling me about the adventures in his time with Star Trek. But this is so exciting, and to move on to the stars, I just want to remind you and the listeners that the last mission that we had, of course, with Jeff Bezos on there and the other astronauts, and then the oldest woman to go to space, Wally Funk, they reached an altitude of 351,210 feet above the Earth. That's 66.52 miles. And just to give everybody out there, Frank, in radio land, an understanding of what this means as far as we know what 66.52 miles is like. But more realistically, right there from WABC, if you were from downtown Manhattan, it would be as if you went from there over to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and just move that ruler, if you had one, straight up into the sky. So even though it is the edge of space, it's still not way out, as many people may think. I mean, this is a suborbital flight. And the technology behind this that Bezos has been working on for well over 10 years, or more, actually 20 years, is quite impressive. This one is not going to include Jeff Bezos. It's obviously William Shatner, Audrey Powers, and two co-founders of their own companies, a gentleman from Planet Labs, the co-founder, and a gentleman from Metadata, and also another high technology company, are going to take that 11-minute ride to space, like the most amazing adult amusement park ride we can think of, right, Frank?
Absolutely. Now, to me, space counts when you go above where the sky is blue and it's dark again, and especially if there's a low gravity or zero gravity environment. To me, that counts as space. Now, before we get into the particulars of how long they're going to be up there and how what they're going to be doing up there, if anything, when is this happening? Give us the who, what, when, and where. How can people watch this? When is it happening? What's the story?
Best question I've had all day, and it's obviously very simple. Go to Blue Origin's YouTube channel, and this is actually going to begin. The launch is scheduled, as if things go well, and they should, 8:30 a.m. Central Daylight Time is what's going to happen. Of course, 9:30 back on the East Coast and appropriate times across the country. But you can watch on Blue Origin's YouTube channel to watch the entire proceedings. And it's going to happen a few hours before that they're going to turn this on. And as always, exciting technology, but even more exciting is obviously, and I don't know this for sure, but I'm pretty confident that they're going to actually show you what's happening. And that's the part we want to see when these four lucky individuals get to go weightless for a period of time. So that's how people can watch this. And this is going to become commonplace, we hope, within the next few years, where more and more people will be able to cross that Kármán line, that imaginary line that's in space. You know, it's not there. You can't see it with a ruler and say, oh, look up there. There's that big red line. I know that's where space begins. This is exciting. And I can only imagine, Frank, think back maybe 30 or 40 years ago, we wouldn't be doing this kind of a show. It would be almost, what, more in the realm of super science fiction?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how long is this four-person crew going to be up there? What sort of experiments, if any, are they doing while they're up there? Or is it just sort of a quick joyride where they go up and go down?
Well, and I don't know all the fine details, but I can tell you this. The last time that Bezos did it, he brought a pair of goggles from Amelia Earhart to space. And he brought one of the first hot air balloons. He had like a little plaque or something, a medallion from one of the first hot air balloons. But each of these individuals, as we will then call them astronauts, they're allowed to bring what they call a blue bag. How convenient, from Blue Origin. You can bring some of your own artifacts into space, but you have to sign, how about this, a document saying that you will not sell any of these artifacts that you're taking up into space. So I don't know of any pre-planned serious scientific experiments that are happening, because remember, it's only about an 11-minute flight, and I wonder how much science you can pack into that. So basically, these lucky individuals will get to experience a few minutes of weightlessness, look and see the curvature of the Earth as they move from daylight, or if it's slightly cloudy, up to this thin, super thin part of the Earth's atmosphere, or just beyond that, where they get to see the whole... Imagine looking out from these big windows, and then as that capsule moves away from this particular rocket itself, which is 59 feet tall, then we have the slow descent and the parachute landing, and it lands so soft that if you were standing right under it, well, you probably wouldn't want to do that, but it's not going to slam to the ground, and lucky for those, that's a conclusion of going to space.
So they're not going to be up there for weeks, days, just a few minutes, essentially.
No, and I need to qualify this. I mean, some of the technicals here, I mean, people can, of course, scour the internet for the information here, but I wanted to give you the quick 101 on this because I know people really care about it. Blue Origin, this particular spacecraft is known as the New Shepard rocket and the New Shepard spacecraft, named in honor of Alan Shepard's first flight back in May of 1961, when he rode the lowest bidder project on the Redstone rocket. And that's a long story that we'd probably take hours to go through about some of the travails of that experience. But they're replicating as best as we can a suborbital flight, because remember, America was not the first to do a orbital flight. It was Yuri Gagarin, of course, as they celebrate every year in April, Yuri's night. But it was interesting that it was then John Glenn who made our first circumnavigation or orbital flight. And the spacecraft in the Blue Origin lineup are something like this. You have the New Shepard rocket and this particular spacecraft. Then they're developing the New Glenn orbital rocket. That's something that's coming. And they also have, obviously, everything in the blue line. They have the Blue Moon lander. And these are all courtesy of a rocket engine, Frank, that's interesting. They're using the BE-3. And what's that? It's a rocket that's powered by liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. And it generates about 110,000 pounds of thrust up to space. And then as the rocket throttles down, this engine and this second, you know, the main stage, the 60-foot section of the rocket, will come down with some 20,000 pounds of thrust as it slowly throttles down and gives us that amazing experience. That is the rocket body itself, where the astronauts are not in. But the capsule soft lands with a parachute system. But I'm so amazed. I mean, every time, the first time I ever saw what SpaceX did on this, I went, what the heck is that? The soft landing of the booster rocket that just took off? And it landed pretty much right in the bullseye. That's even more incredible.
It really is. So you will, and if people are just tuning in, we're talking space. It's space day, all space, all the time. William Shatner's going to space at least for a few minutes. You can watch it live on the YouTube channel in just over 8 hours. I am going to, that's usually one of the few hours of the day that I'm sleeping. I'm going to postpone my morning slumber so that I could stay up to watch this. We're talking with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. If you like what you hear from him, if you're impressed with his insight into space or astronomy or anything we cover, you want to check out KTAR.com. There's a great Dr. Sky blog on there, and there's some links to a lot of great things that he's done on the radio. That's KTAR.com. Steve, you alluded to the fact that this essentially could be the future of recreational space travel, what Shatner is doing and what Blue Origin is doing in general. How soon, and I know I ask you this seemingly every month that we speak, what is the realistic timetable for when someone can buy a ticket to go to space and go?
Well, I think from a financial standpoint, let me start with that part of the answer. I think this is still a decade or so away. But I think for those that can afford these flights, and now, folks, you know, this is amazing. The flights that these folks are on involved in range anywhere, as I heard. I mean, this is not, I don't have any direct connection to any of these individuals, but just scouring the internet and talking to some of the people in the space program, we're looking upwards of $20 to $30 million per ride. Yes, $20 to $30 million per ride. And Shatner, I don't think, obviously is paying. I haven't got a confirmation on that because of his notoriety and, of course, his celebrity status. But simply this, I think we're going to be seeing this, Frank, in the probably a decade away. But even on the low end, what Virgin Galactic was talking about was taking deposits for people to do this on their type of craft, you know, which is dropped from a mothership, which actually is a rocket plane, which I think is just as cool. And maybe even cooler if you want to think about flying in some kind of an aircraft, spacecraft, space plane. They were doing like around $200,000 per individual. So I don't know about you, Frank. I mean, I can't run to the ATM tonight and, you know, pay for myself. But, you know, I think maybe 10 years or even maybe more where the price would actually come down. But even if it was $50,000 or $25,000, that's still pretty pricey.
Oh, no, that's for sure. It's a, yeah. To me, it's a crapshoot whether the $500 check that I wrote yesterday will be cashed before I get paid on Friday. So I can that $200,000 is still a little bit outside of my price range. So we'll see what happens. But God bless those that that can afford to do it. All right. Mm-hmm. Let me get your take on a few other things. By the way, we're going to try and take your calls for Dr. Sky if you have questions about space. You can give us a call at 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Now, we are having some problems with static on the phone lines. So, not with you, Steve, but for on some of the caller lines. So, if you call in and we don't put you on the air, don't take it personally. It's because you're the victim of technology, probably the solar flares, which we'll get to a little
bit
later.
That's exactly right, Frank. I'm glad you brought that up, because that seriously could be what's affecting this phone.
Well, so let's talk about that, since that leads naturally to where we are. What happened with this solar flare on Monday, and why is it having such a deleterious effect on technology here on Earth?
Well, let's start from the beginning. This is solar cycle 25. It followed 24. And as long as we've been able to capture individual, you know, sunspots and solar cycles, what's very interesting here for the listeners to note is the old solar cycle 24, Frank, was really slow to actually end and then kick in with solar cycle 25. If you look a year or two ago, the sun was spotless for a period of time, which is almost a year. But yesterday, if you look at the sunspot count, it's increasing. Yesterday's sunspot total was 38. Now, what does that mean? There were three major areas of concern on the sun. One of them right now, if people go to like a place called spaceweather.com, you get to see the live image of the sun. There's an area on the sun right now called Active Region 2882. What is that? It's one of these gigantic sunspots. How big is that? Many times the size of the Earth, probably even the size of Neptune or the planet Uranus. And this particular space, this particular sunspot group actually produced a very strong M1 class 6 level, I should say, solar flare. What does that mean? It means that the Earth was grazed and hit by an incredible, well, I should say a mild, to be honest with everybody, a mild geostorm. And guess what happened yesterday? The auroras were visible, which usually are the part that gets excited in the ionosphere after you have these solar storms, all the way down to places, and I even saw pictures from places in Massachusetts, maybe even some of the listeners who live up in New York State and up in the areas of New England. They were easily seen as a red glow on the horizon. The farther north you went, you got to see this most magnificent display of auroras. I remember as a child living in the New York area, Frank, back around 1969, we had this most amazing, gigantic aurora that was visible all through the New York area. So it's not uncommon that we get to see these things. So the solar cycle is increasing. Solar cycle 25 is on the uptick. And it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when we do get hit by some of these most massive of CMEs, coronal mass ejections. And let's hope that, of course, the sun blows them off to the side so they're not direct Earth killers or direct Earth hitters.
So when you use that term, Earth killers, these CMEs could actually destroy the Earth?
Well, here's the simple answer on this. Back in 1859, the most amazing, and I think it was one of the most amazing events that has ever happened in solar, you know, in tracking sunspots and solar storms. It was called the Great Carrington Event in September of that year. And that's way before we had the internet, obviously. We had telegraphs. What happened is that particular sunspot group was visible by an astronomer named Carrington, of course. He actually drew it with pen and ink. Unbeknownst to him, that particular event took place about 14 hours later. The Earth was hit with such an incredible solar storm that auroras, Frank, were visible all the way to the equator. And people thought the skies were on fire. But even more interesting, in those days when telegraphs were like the new internet, some of the telegraph lines actually caught fire from the induction event from this particular type of solar storm. And that is one of them. That's one of the biggest ones. There was also one in New York in 1921 called the Great Railroad Storm. People can look this up. in which so much energy from the sun actually knocked out telegraph lines, and in that day, a little more advanced technology than in 1859, but it affected the trains in the New York area and the Northeast. And the other major one happened in 1989, and that was the great Quebec solar storm. And what did that do? It knocked out the power grid in Canada, at least for the northeastern part of Canada, from Quebec all the way through Ontario. And the reason that these solar storms can be more, how do I say this, more effective at doing their damage, it depends on the ground that's below it. And here's the problem with the ground area around that part of, you know, eastern Canada. It's made mostly of very heavy rock like granite. So what happens is when these solar storms strike the earth, they get sucked into the poles. And a lot of that overdue energy or excess energy is trying to get down into the earth, of course, to ground level. They call it a ground level event. So when you have that hard porous rock, or non-porous rock that you have like in that area, the earth can't absorb that hit. So what happens is anything that's electrical is going to be affected by that. And that's one of the reasons why. And the whole New York City area is basically what? What's Manhattan built on? I mean, pretty much hard rock like granite, sure. I imagine. So, yeah, I mean, not to go too detailed in this, but obviously to answer your questions, these solar storms are on the uptick. And not to alarm people, I mean, early this morning on a beautiful morning as we move into Wednesday and a great space event about to happen. It's just that these solar storms, because why? What's happening to us, Frank? It won't destroy the Earth, but we're so dependent on electronic technology. And also the problem of electromagnetic pulse, you know, let's say a rogue nation wants to launch a ICBM into the atmosphere, you can do a lot of damage and don't give anybody any ideas. But that's already a fear that many people have in the military world. But the sun, ever so powerful, you know, all weather comes from the sun. And that's another big subject that we could talk about sometime, the effects of what's happening, whether people believe in climate change or not. But these solar storms, they can and will do more damage to our satellites. Look how crowded low Earth orbit is, right?
Wait, quick question, though, with respect to the sun and what we saw on Monday. I had read that these CMEs and everything that was happening with the sun over the last day or two would actually make it potentially possible for Aurora Borealis to be viewed here in New York, which it's generally not viewed. Now, I was looking at the sky. I didn't notice anything. And it was one of the few hours of the day or a few of the few hours that I'm actually sober during the day. I'm wondering, did that not happen, and if so, why not?
Well, here's the answer. It did happen last night, and I say last night, meaning the night before, because I'm here in Phoenix, and it's still Tuesday night. So
sure.
Monday night, the skies were illuminated back into the United States, where it really hasn't happened with great intensity. Areas like above latitude, let's go for the latitude. Areas like at least plus 50 degrees latitude up in northern Canada, areas in Alaska, plus in the 60s, they get to see this all the time. Norway, Sweden. I mean, there's actually groups that will take you on these amazing excursions. I think we should do this with the 77 WABC audience. Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be fun.
To look at this most amazing thing called an auroral display. But this has happened, and I can't say for sure, because you have to be out at the right time of night. And you know what happens? I remember seeing a really good display in southern Ontario, Canada, about 30 years ago. We were on a fishing trip, and we were a bunch of guys on an island. We flew in one of these little seaplane-type things, a float plane. And we couldn't go anywhere for the week because that's the whole point. You stood there, you brought your food. I came out one morning in Canada in the middle of summer, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And here's what I saw, Frank. Out of a clear sky, I noticed this curtain-like effect of green light on the horizon expanding almost halfway up in the sky. They call these curtain auroras. So the aurora borealis are, of course, triggered by these solar storms in the southern hemisphere, the aurora australis. But that's something that if people haven't seen it, well, it may be coming to a neighborhood near you sooner than we think with the solar intensity.
Do we expect any more electronic or technological problems as a result of the CME that took place Monday?
Well, not really. I mean, the only thing that we can tell people definitively from this particular storm, and they come pretty regularly now. I mean, some are mild. These are G-class flares on the sun. There's a lower intensity than the big boys. And they start off with flare classifications B, C, M, and the X. Run like hell if it's an X flare because that's a bad one.
Well, where would you run? Where would you run?
Well, I guess you want to go inside a cave, maybe deep inside a mine, because like I said before, the ability for the energy that comes from these things, they're kind of repelled or repulsed when the ground is super hard, like granite. So that might be a safe place to go if you wanted to protect yourself, but come on. Who has that capability? Unless we want to go by and share in a ICBM silo that's been left open there, we can maybe hide. But the answer, seriously, Frank, is that these things have happened in history, and they will continue to happen. But since the population on the Earth is so much larger than it was in 1859, obviously people know that. But the intensity and use and dependence on electronic technology, I don't know what would happen to electric cars. I don't know how well that would obviously prevail if you had one of these big solar storms. Everything in our lives. I mean, look how many people put most of their life on the little gadget we call a smartphone. And imagine if it was summarily just, nixed and wiped out because of one of these high-intensity flares.
Let me ask you to pause right there. We're going to continue in just a minute with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. If you have a question for him, we'll try and get it in. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Do you remember Sodom and Gomorrah? If you do, well, you might be interested to learn that we might have found the location of where that actually was on Earth. We'll get into it next. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno, joined for the hour by my friend Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky, one of the finest edutainers available in the world. And if you're interested in discussion of space or astronomy or anything that's interesting that involves looking up, Steve Cates is your man. You can read his blog and even hear some of his work by going to ktar.com. That's ktar.com, benefiting from his expertise on a wide variety of issues today. And we're going to take your calls in just a minute at 800-848-9222. We have a lot to cover. I alluded, Steve, to Sodom and Gomorrah. Let me ask you about this. This is a fascinating story that broke this week that Sodom and Gomorrah might have been destroyed by a cosmic fireball. And this comes to us not necessarily from the Bible, but this comes to us from evidence that's been found here on Earth. I think a lot of us know the Old Testament story of Sodom and Gomorrah, that these cities that were destroyed because they were so sinful. What did we learn this week about what the evidence suggests about Sodom and Gomorrah?
Well, this is fascinating, as you're talking about here. Scientists at the University of California in Santa Barbara and their field expeditions over to Jordan. This is the area of the nation itself of Jordan. They're talking about something that may now be contrarian to the Bible, but here we go from science. 3,650 years ago, their explanation is because of artifacts that are found on the ground and in that area and digging, as archaeologists would do. They're saying that there was this high potential that at that time, 3,650 years ago, a huge flaming object came out of the sky and literally incinerated the so-called 8,000 inhabitants that lived in this part of the world. And that 20 or so miles away, part of the biblical story of the walls, of Jericho, they came tumbling down, also may be connected somewhat to this new scientific find. And what they're saying is they've looked at artifacts where things were turned to glass. Obviously, they didn't find human remains. But this is kind of interesting. The fire and brimstone, something from science here, may indeed have been one of the answers, or if not the answer, to what really happened there. And not to go against the Bible, but this is something fascinating. And as scientists continue to explore this area, they also make a correlation to other events that happened on the Earth. Back on June 30th of 1908, many people may know that in northern Siberia, in the middle of the day, there was an event called the Tunguska event. And what was this all about? A huge flaming object, as the inhabitants wrote back in that time, last century. People witnessed during the middle of the day, and these were mostly farmers and agricultural people, and shepherds. Some of the documents that were written stated that during the middle of the day, a huge screeching object literally, quote, tore the sky apart. And this object may have been part of a nucleus of a comet. One of the comets that they point their finger at is a piece of Comet Encke. How big was this object? Well, we don't know for sure, but it may be a couple of hundred feet, maybe even 500 feet across. It didn't hit the ground. it exploded above the ground. And when it did, this is interesting, Frank, as more evidence that these things come from space and can do damage, a tremendous amount, maybe the size of the state of Connecticut, was wiped out with trees, the big giant trees, you know, ones that were, you know, 20, 30, 40 inches in diameter or maybe bigger, were all knocked down like toothpicks in a direction away from the epicenter of the blast. And it took a Russian scientist named Kulik about maybe 30 years later to actually, 20 years later, to actually have an expedition there. And they found evidence of something in the soil, which is iridium, which means that there's a telltale sign of something that happened. They know something exploded. And the most recent one that we can talk about was back in 2013 when people in Russia, actually during the morning hours, it's all over YouTube, the Chelyabinsk event was an object from space, a piece of an asteroid, get a load of this, 66 feet across, that comes, as you see in the video, just streaking across the sky, brighter than the sun. And once again, it didn't hit the ground to explode. It airburst, and it sent 1,000 or more people to hospitals because of the shockwave that was produced by the Chelyabinsk explosion. So going back to this whole thing of Sodom and Gomorrah, they overlaid the explosive force of what the Tunguska event was and put it over the map and tried to correlate the size of this object. So it may have been a similar size. It may have been something that's a couple of hundred feet across to do that much damage. And we here, Frank, not to be part of the Arizona Tourism Bureau, we have one of the best relics of a crater that's been preserved, the Arizona Meteor Crater. And that story goes that 50,000 years ago, a 200-foot in diameter object, not that massive, you know, maybe the size of a 747 aircraft, actually came down at a slight angle and created this explosive force so great like a nuclear explosion. And if anybody hasn't seen it, it's amazing. I've stood there many times and looked over the walls of this crater, and it's like a mile and a half or a mile-ish in diameter. And somebody jokingly said when they were looking for a home for the Arizona Cardinals football team, they said, well, hey, how about we just make a stadium out of the Arizona Meteor Crater? Of course, that was being facetious. But the question was, how many people and fans could you fit in there? And the calculation comes out from architects very accurately. You could fit 1 million sports fans in that crater. How about that?
That is wild. All right. A lot of people very patiently waiting to talk to you. 800-848-9222. Let's begin with Ted in Forest Hills. Ted, you're on with Steve Cates.
Yeah, my wife's hometown is Chelyabinsk.
Good morning. Oh, wow.
She's Russian. Yes. Now, I wanted to ask, every time Dr. Sky is on, it just cheers me up.
Same here.
That just cheers me up.
Well,
now, I wanted to ask him, which is shaking me, is the Webb Space Telescope. That seems to be so complicated.
It is.
Do you think it will go up, and do you think they can make it go to the Lagrange 2 point?
I think they can, but here's the big problem. And we were saying this, and sorry, Ted, if you didn't hear the other show on this. This is supposed to be going to a launch date in October. Yeah, October is now. And the problem was they had to put this on a big ship. And there was actually rumors out there that pirates might be looking to confiscate or capture this object and hold it for ransom. That's a crazy story unto itself. But if it all goes well, it'll obviously meet its place to be launched on a large Ariane rocket in French Guiana. And then, hopefully, if the rocket goes off like it should, it's a very complicated piece of space machinery, and it will eventually wind up being at one of these Lagrange points. And what is that for everybody listening? It's a point out in space where you have the ability to keep it singularly in space, where it's not seemingly tracking across our skies. It's like your geosynchronous satellites in a small way. But what this is going to be doing, it's a 21-foot in diameter mirror that's on this. It makes the 94-inch or so mirror on the Hubble Space Telescope, you know, tiny, like a small pea next to the size of a big size of a fresh orange. So this is fascinating. I don't know the actual update on the launch date, but I'm pretty sure that they've got this figured out, and it will be a most amazing piece of technology. And from the political side, Ted, you probably heard that there are actually some questions about why they were naming it for one of the, you know, directors of NASA at the time, James Webb, because people were claiming that he had all kinds of issues in his past. I'm not judging the man. I didn't know him. But they were going to name it for somebody else. So the whole controversy around this Webb telescope, it's just amazing. I just hope it gets to that Lagrange point just like you're talking about.
Thank you, Ted. 800-848-WABC. Let's say hello to Mark in Newark. Hello, Mark.
Thank you, Frank. I want to...
Good morning.
Good morning, Doctor. somebody we never talked about is Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman who went to space in 63, and she's still alive. And I have a question for you, Doctor. How come the planet Jupiter does not swallow all this moon around her?
I'm sorry, I'm having a little trouble, Frank. You're right. The static is over.
Yeah, Mark, try one more time to repeat that, because I didn't make out what your question was either.
I didn't understand what the static. I apologize, Mark.
Maybe my accent, too.
No, that's okay. Go ahead, sir.
We never talk about Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman who went to space in 63 for 3 days. And my question is, why the planet Jupiter does not swallow all this planet around her?
Well, I got the part about Valentina Tereshkova, Mark, and I can just tell you this. She was obviously a hero of the Soviet Union, and it's true that there was a lot of controversy about sending a female to space. Obviously, they should have, and they did. But I don't know the rest of that story. I didn't quite hear the rest of the question.
Yeah, me neither. So maybe we'll hold off. We'll hold off on the phone calls.
I apologize, Mark. We're trying hard here, but we do hear a lot of stuff.
Not your fault. Now, in terms of a story that our mutual friend and our owner, John Catsimatidis, sent me as soon as it broke, that I found pretty interesting, is the story of radio signals possibly coming from exoplanets. And as soon as John sent it to me, the story of these strange radio waves coming from the heart of the Milky Way coming from the heart of the Milky Way, I said to John, this is going to be something that I ask Dr. Sky about this week when he's on. John said, great. He'll know exactly what the story is. So tell us what the story is here. What do we know about these unusual radio waves coming from the center of the Milky Way galaxy?
Well, this is an interesting developing story. And again, what I can share with the listeners and yourself here this morning is that for the first time, radio telescopes are picking up some kind of a signal that has not been detected before. But if they focus the beam of this radio telescope, remember, radio telescopes, the larger the big dish, obviously the bigger and more sensitive you have in a capability to see or resolve things. It's a little different than an optical telescope and kind of different. So what we're finding out is some kind of a signal is actually coming out from regions where we see these little objects around stars. And this is bizarre because imagine this about 30 or 40 years ago, talking about planetary systems around other stars. I mean, we have enough with our own solar system here with the fight about Pluto as a dwarf or whatever. But these objects or the signals may indeed be coming from exoplanetary system or exoplanetary objects around these stars. Now, what does that mean? A planet with some sort of signal could mean something, and that if you connect the dots, maybe some sort of a signal, as weak as it is, of some sort of intelligence out there. It's still too early. Like I said, this is a developing story. But here's the problem you have with even the radio telescopes. We have a number of other signals that are coming out from the core of the Milky Way and throughout the entire part of this vast galaxy and other galaxies. We're having these fast radio bursts. Now, what are these? What astronomers think fast radio bursts are something where you may have these pulsars, these stars that are maybe the size of the Earth. That's true. The size of the Earth, where the actual surface is so magnetized that if you were to scoop up with a teaspoon, it would weigh more than a giant U.S. Navy aircraft carrier because of the compression of all the matter that's in there. And what they do is when they spin, they send out this thing through what they call this sounds bizarre to most people, Frank, but it's a fact. They have what's called starquakes. And the surface of the star, as rigid and unbelievable as this is for our minds to imagine, can actually break like you'd have a tectonic plate. And it sends out this most incredible, powerful gamma ray burst that would literally, if we had one of these, close enough to the sun or close enough to the Earth, life on Earth as we know it would not exist biologically. It's that powerful. But that's where you have the problem. You have a mix of these signals. So they're picking up this faint little signal. It's like, say, a radio station that's operating on 10 watts. And now you have all these other radio stations, like this great one, operating on really high power. And somehow we're being able to see in between that field spectrum where we're picking up something. But the funny story I'll leave you with, too, is that astronomers thought one time at one of the great radio telescopes in the United States, in the Green Bank radio telescope that actually collapsed in West Virginia, astronomers one night were so excited they heard this noise and they heard this signal and they started recording it. And guess what they found out? It wasn't extraterrestrial at all. It was the microwave oven down the hall. Somebody started to heat up a cup of coffee.
But we don't think that's the case with these exoplanets. We don't think that's a microwave oven, or as they say in the film American Hustle, science oven related.
Too early to tell, though, Frank, on this story. But we'll be following it, of course. And you know we'll be talking about this because they had one signal a long time ago called the WOW signal. And a radio telescope astronomer, I believe it was the University of Ohio or in Ohio, actually detected this pattern that repeated for a while and never was heard again. And if people just look up the WOW signal, they'll get all the details on what that was all about, because that kind of got everybody thinking, hey, we finally found it. And they're still searching. And that's amazing, because I guess the whole Fermi paradox is based on, with all the signals that we've sent out into space, how come we've never been able to get a signal back? And some hypothesize that there's something out there, which is called the Great Filter, and it means that maybe somehow someone or something out there, maybe a bigger power than we know, doesn't want us to figure that out by letting those signals through. That sounds bizarre, but that's something of – it's very plausible.
Interesting, interesting. You know, this is actually a pretty interesting question from one of our listeners. And if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky. You can check out his blog and some of his work at ktar.com. There's nobody better. The question that was emailed into me, and if people can't get through on the phones, they can email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. The question that was emailed into me is, do you think – that junk science negatively affects how the public regards and supports real scientific investigation and discovery, because real science is less sexy or spectacular. Oh, yeah. And the example this listener gives is the SETI project versus space aliens in New Jersey. Is that something that hinders real science?
Well, absolutely. But let me say this. I don't want to stand on a big soapbox like I'm pontificating, like I have all the answers out there. I'm just another human, too, that loves the subject as people do out there. But here it is. The biggest misnomer that I have out there is every time we go to the Internet for information, somehow many people think, and they know most people, you know, I guess have their right to decide. Everybody does. But here's the big one. Every day there's another asteroid that's coming close to the Earth. And if you read some of the stories, I don't know who they were written by, but they're not really that professionally written as far as the science in them. But the point is, some of that stuff is just garbage. And I have to say it just the way I feel it. Every week, every day, there's an asteroid coming close to the Earth. But the way the whole stories are written, Frank, I think people figure this out too, is that, oh my gosh, this asteroid's coming and it's going to hit the Earth. Or, no, no, they don't say hit the Earth. Excuse me, let me backtrack. There's an asteroid coming very, very close to the Earth, and it's a really large thing. It's thousands of feet. It's a couple of miles in diameter. But the problem is they don't really explain to you that that's 4 or 5 million miles away.
I see.
So that adds to what I consider to be the junk science, to take away from what the real astronomy is. And the other big controversy was with the object that a good friend of mine, Bob Wierick, out in Hawaii, discovered the object called Oumuamua, which in Hawaiian means scout. It's an object that was detected after its closest passage into the solar system. But it didn't come from the solar system, Frank. It came from another star system. At least that's what we think trajectory. And then the object was seen, get a load of this, folks, Frank, it was seen accelerating as it left the solar system. That's highly unusual. So many people jump to the conclusion that it's an interplanetary spacecraft. But who knows? But the point is, from Rob Wierick's work, they're looking at it from a purely scientific view. And the evidence would show, at least from what they've got, that it probably was this pancake flattened type object that was reddish in color, but not necessarily an interplanetary spacecraft. I kind of wish it was, but then you know how the Internet would just extrapolate these stories to the point of absurdity.
We're going to try to take another call again that I'm told has our call screener Pete's ringing endorsement in terms of being static free. Let's say hello to John in the Bronx. John, you're on with Steve Cates.
Good morning,
John. Hi, Frank, Mr. Sky. Yes, Dr. Sky, I forget which way you...
We'll take it either way. He's not too formal.
Good morning. Well, I have to find out something. I always contemplate this, and it boggles my mind. But when you think about it, it always mentions the four corners of the universe, as if it's a block, a big empty space block, and then you get to the wall. But for a wall to exist, something has to contain it from the outside of it. Mm-hmm. So there never really could be an end to the space.
You're right. Absolutely. And this is interesting. 13.8 billion years ago, we believe, at least scientists do, that we know the Big Bang happened. What happened was, this is interesting, because if people think, as they did, John, going back into history when we had to believe religiously that the Earth was the center of the entire universe and people died because they believed that the sun was the center, and we had a story we could go on. But if you look at the universe cosmologically, the explanation, you know, the explanation of how the universe began, remember this. The universe did not explode around us. It exploded out in space, so it's constantly moving out. And the actual dimension, somebody would say, well, the edge of the universe is 13.8 billion light years away. No, it's actually, if you measured the actual, if it is a sphere, allegedly the whole thing is maybe 90 billion light years in size. So many people have a misnomer that this whole thing has a wall. No, it doesn't. And one of the most bizarre things, John, that we're talking about, at least in the depth of cosmology, is that what most people in Einstein couldn't figure this out, something in gravity is accelerating the universe as it goes farther out. You would explain if something exploded, eventually it's going to slow down. But something that we don't quite understand in gravity is this dark energy. And I'm saying to you and everybody listening, there's no wall there. It's just infinite space. But yet, I'm not even smart enough to figure out where it all came from before the Big Bang. How about that, Frank?
Thank you, John. 800-848-WABC. We're going to continue with Dr. Sky in just a moment. But one of the mysteries we're contemplating, not in space or in the sky, but here on Earth, is how bad inflation is going to get. It seems like the value of money costs less and less. Headline today that I saw, some gas stations here in New York City are up to $5 a gallon. You imagine $5 a gallon. And it's not just gas that's going up. Food prices through the roof. Price of everything is going through the roof. Inflation is out of control. So what can you do? Well, that's where precious metals come in, because gold, silver, and other precious metals can be a hedge against inflation. And that's important for you to know if you're either retired now or if you're planning to retire soon, because Legacy Precious Metals wants to help you whip inflation now, just like Gerald Ford wanted to. So if you have an existing retirement account, think about rolling it into a gold or a silver IRA, and think about doing it with Legacy Precious Metals. You can avoid the financial carnage that people are overinvested in stocks, which is looking more and more like a bubble, are going to have to deal with. Gold should be a part of every investor's portfolio, and it should certainly be a part of yours. Legacy is the company that you can trust because they give you unbiased counsel based on your individual situation. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today. Call 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635, or you can visit legacypminvestments.com.
WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
When a star is born, they possess a gift or two. One of them is this, to make your dreams come true.
When you wish upon a star, makes no...
Dion and the Belmonts, When You Wish Upon a Star. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We're talking with Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky, about all things happening in the night sky these days. Steve, last time you were here, I bought a new pair of binoculars based on your recommendation of the specifications. What can I use them for? Anything in our area that people will be able to see that's pretty exciting or noteworthy?
Well, here we go with the live sky, and we're talking satellites. Tonight, sky conditions are clear, hopefully there in the New York area, the listening area. You have an opportunity, more specifically the New York area, at 7:25 p.m., coming out of the southwest sky, use the moon and the south as a guide, out of the southwest will be the X-37B. This is the so-called little secret spy plane, or spy craft. It's actually a spacecraft that will be sailing across our skies. I've watched it before. It's been up there for maybe 700 or more days, doing God knows what kind of experiments, testing out new thrusters. But here's something in the future. On the morning of October the 21st, mark the time down of 6:26 a.m. The International Space Station makes a nice passage over the New York listening area, some 41 degrees high into the southeast sky. You'll be able to see this with the naked eye. And then on October the 20th, the Chinese space station in evolution, like a big Lego block in the sky, they're going to build more to this. October the 20th, 7:42 p.m., you'll be able to look nearly overhead and see this object. Now, you need a fairly dark sky to see this, but a pair of binoculars, that will help. And here we go, a couple of other little tips. Over the next few nights, the moon will glide past two interesting planets, the planet Saturn, the ring planet. Binoculars won't show you the ring, but you'll notice a conjunction, a close coming together of two celestial objects. First Saturn, as we move into tonight, and then tomorrow night as it moves into then Thursday, you'll see that the moon glides past Jupiter. That's the bright object that you can see any night, high into the southeast at sunset, a beautiful sight. So many cool things here coming up, Frank, in the month of November. We'll have so much to talk about. But again, this is just an amazing time of the year. For most parts of the nation, the cloud systems usually kind of moderate a little bit. And I remember when living back in the New York area at that time, you had better skies in October and November than you did during the summer months, as we have here, unfortunately, the big monsoon. That's gone. So it's a great time to observe. And on a personal note, I want to say hi to you because I was watching you and John Castamatidis on the amazing video feed that you guys had sitting outside on the Columbus Day Parade. That was really cool.
Well, thank you. Nice. Thank you. We had a lot of fun there. And
that was awesome.
Maybe next Columbus Day Parade. Something tells me we're going to be back there again. Maybe next Columbus Day Parade, if you happen to be in the New York area, you can join us. We had a lot of fun, and there were a lot of great dignitaries that passed by, a lot of great listeners.
Oh, yeah.
And Calandra's Bakery and Grimaldi sent over some great food, which is the last thing that I needed. But it certainly was a lot of fun, I'll tell you.
Would have loved to have some of that food.
That's for sure. How is the Italian food in Arizona? My uncle Caesar, who was passed away, but he lived in Arizona for a time. He said that there were a handful of places in his area where you could find good Italian food. I'm curious about your take.
Well, here it is. As a New Yorker myself, when I came out here, I'm here 32 years, love New York, of course. But here, to answer your question, one of my favorites, and here goes a selfless plug here, a place in Scottsdale called Uncle Sal's. It's a small restaurant. But if you like veal, boy, it's done up just right, because that's getting hard to find in restaurants. And, of course, so much of the pizza that we have out here, there are different parts of the country, Chicago pizza, you name it, Los Angeles pizza. But I have friends out here in certain restaurants that are right New Yorkers, and they came out here, and they do it right. But I guess they just don't have the right water, you know what I'm saying, to make that right. But it's close enough. And it's good for me. And, yeah, we have some good Italian restaurants here.
All right. Well, next time I'm in Arizona, I'm going to check out that Uncle Sal's. The place that I've heard, as far as Phoenix goes, that gets pretty good reviews in terms of pizza is a place called Pizzeria Bianco. They're from New York, and apparently the margarita pizza is pretty good, although I can't say firsthand, just secondhand. All right. I'm going to try and squeeze in at least one more call here, and we'll weave our way through the static. Joe is in Queens. Joe, you're on with Steve Cates. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Steve.
Good morning, Joe.
Yeah, just a probe or a craft, say, approaching a planet in our solar system. What are the obstacles to, say, approaching the surface of Saturn, as per one example? Like, would there be obstacles to actually land something on the surface?
Right. The planet Saturn, which is a gas giant, that'd be pretty formidable because from most of the knowledge we have of Saturn, it's mostly gaseous, just like Jupiter, those two planets that I described that you can see high in the south and just around sunset. That would be pretty difficult. But if I was doing this, I would be, and spacecraft have done this, one of the most amazing objects, Joe, that's right around Saturn as one of its satellites is the largest satellite in the solar system that has an atmosphere called Titan. And that's a place that we sent a probe down, and we found out that there's actually liquid lakes there on Titan, some of which are so large, they're as big as some of like the Caspian Sea would be here on the Earth, and like the Great Lakes, they contain mostly octane, which is what? Part, Frank, I guess, of how we make gasoline, and now that it's $5 a gallon in New York, let's bring some of that stuff back our way. But that's very difficult to land any type of a spacecraft on those gaseous planets, the big size of Saturn and Jupiter. The pressures would be just so great. And we, of course, really don't know what's below the clouds.
Thank you very much for the call, Joe. Steve, it is always a treat to be able to talk with you whenever we speak. The hour just flies by. And if people want to see more of your work, they can go to ktar.com. I get a ton of interesting stuff in terms of show ideas, even when you're not on the show, by reading your blog. And I think our listeners will get a great deal out of it as well.
Thank you so much for having me. Always enjoy it.
Thank you. Steve Cates, a.k.a. Dr. Sky, the one and the only.